in the heat of the summer, when the pavements were burning, soul of a city was ravaged in the night. After the city sun was sinking, now no one knows how it started, why the windows were shattered. But deep in the dark, someone set the spark, and then it no longer mattered. Down the street they were rumbling, all the tempers were raging. Oh, where are the white silver tongues who forgot to listen to the warning? On and on came the angry, no longer following reason, and all the stores were the target now, where just the other day they were buying, drunk with the memory of the ghetto, drunk with the lure of the looting, and the memory of the uniforms shoving with their sticks, asking, are you looking for trouble? No, 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 moaned the mayor. Stop the way of the order. Oh, stay in your homes, please leave us alone. We'll be glad to talk in the morning. For shame, wrote the papers. Why the hurry to your hunger? Now the rubble's resting on your broken streets. So see what your rage has unraveled. Barricades sadly were rising. Bricks were heavily flying. And the loudspeaker drowned like a whispering sound when compared to the angered emotion. And when the fury was over and the shame was replacing the anger, so wrong, but we've been down too long and we had to make somebody listen in the heat of the summer.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Francesca Rhiannon interview James Ryson about greed, power, and endless wars. You can listen to this program from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays at 96.5 FM, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
But so much of what you talk about in Pay Any Price, James Ryson, is this whole industrial complex. In other words, that it's about greed and, you know, the manipulation of fear in order to support these huge this huge transfer of wealth without very much oversight, as you've said here. Has Obama increased oversight? Has at least any of this money, is this being used more responsibly?
No. In fact, I think one of the legacies of Obama has been to invoke more secrecy and impose more secrecy on this than ever existed before. He's used state secret privilege on many lawsuits brought by people trying to find out information about these programs and crack down on whistleblowers who try to talk about it. And so, in fact, he has invoked a, you know, kind of a cloud of secrecy around this that is more intense than even Bush had.
And you say that secrecy actually breeds corruption.
Yeah. If nobody knows what you're doing, it's easy to get away with this. I mean, that's just human nature. It's transparency. It's openness that forces people to behave. That's just, you know, it's like your kids. If you, you know, if you don't watch your kids and don't know what they're doing, they're going to get into trouble. And the same thing with the national security state. It's no different from your kids.
And of course, we all know that you have been caught up in this whole issue over transparency and secrecy, because you did bring things to light in your last book, A State of War. I mean, the New York Times actually sat on some important revelations that you had that might change the outcome of the 2004 election, although we can never practice counterfactual history here.
Right.
What has been the impact on you of this battle?
Well, you know, I've kind of gotten used to it. My wife and kids have been very supportive, and so that makes a huge difference. And my wife is a former journalist, and so she understands all of these things and has been very supportive. So I'm just kind of learned to live with it and learned to accept the fact that, you know, something may happen, but I don't know what it will be, and I'm just going to keep going. And basically, my real answer to the government was to write this new book and to say that, you know, I'm not going to stop reporting.
And have you seen an impact on your fellow journalists?
From my case?
Yeah, from the prosecution. Well, you haven't been prosecuted, but they're going to haul you into court and try to get you to reveal your sources, and you're going to refuse.
I think what I'm trying to do now, I feel an obligation to kind of represent journalists in this. And so I'm trying to uphold the traditions of the profession. And I'm only doing, I think, what I believe almost any other journalist would do. I don't think I'm doing anything more courageous or different from most of the reporters I know. I think they would all do the same thing in my position. So I'm just trying to represent the profession.
We're talking with James Risen about his new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Now, in the last section of the book, you have three chapters, the war on decency, the war on normalcy, and the war on truth. Let's start with the war on decency, the moral price that we've paid, from Abu Ghraib to civilian deaths from drones. You go deeply into something called the SEER program. Talk about the SEER program.
SEER program was the survival program created by the military for pilots and other personnel who might be captured to give them a simulated training in what it would be like to be subjected to interrogations if they were prisoners of war. That program was started really, I guess, after the Korean War or after the Vietnam War, because so many Americans were brutally treated by the Koreans and the Vietnamese in captivity. And the idea of the program was to help them learn to cope. And what happened after 9/11 was that the CIA, along with some contractors, reverse engineered that program and used that as the basis for their enhanced interrogation program of Al-Qaeda detainees. And what many people now believe, it was a totally misuse of the program, because the SEER techniques, interrogation techniques, were never designed to elicit accurate information. They were designed to show American military personnel what would happen to you if you underwent brutal treatment by an adversary. And it was designed to show how you break people. And so it was a misuse of that program. What I show in the book is that the experts, the academic experts on that program who had studied how U.S. military personnel responded to the SEER interrogation techniques, their research showed that it did not provide accurate information, and it led to short-term memory loss because of the trauma, and so could not have been used to gather accurate information, and that research was ignored by the CIA.
They actually claimed that Abu Zubaydah, you know, they said that under torture he revealed important information, but you track that one down. What did you find out?
Well, I think the Senate, it's one of the points that the Senate and the intelligence report gets into in great detail, I believe. It's already been reported that they have shown that the program didn't work and that the information that supposedly they got from detainees who the government has, some people in the government have tried to argue led to Osama bin Laden, did not lead to bin Laden, and that the torture never provided significant information.
Contrary to the movies.
Yes.
It actually didn't work. But it did have an impact. You tell the story of Damian Corsetti, and here is, you know, one of the prices that we pay, the price we pay in blood, in disorder. In fact, there is now a new term going around the military called moral injury. Tell us about Damian Corsetti. He's really an example of this.
Yeah, Damian Corsetti was an enlisted Army interrogator. He enlisted in the Army and then was made into an interrogator at Bagram in Afghanistan, and then at Abu Ghraib in Iraq. And he came home with severe PTSD from his years of interrogation, and also from the fact that after he returned home, he was put on trial for the harsh interrogations he was involved with at Bagram. And so I profile his life, which is a very sad story, I think, about how he has tried to cope today or since his return home with the trauma, the post-traumatic stress trauma that he is enduring now from having been an interrogator. And he told me that just about everybody in his unit who were involved in interrogations came home with some form of PTSD. And so it shows that, you know, the brutalization of prisoners also brutalizes the Army who does it.
So things were bad enough when you first came out with this book. It hasn't been that long. But since its publication, there's been the midterm elections. Looking into your crystal ball, what do you think will happen with the trends that you point out in your book?
I think that's an interesting question because the Republican Party has been in the midst of a transition on these issues. Traditionally, Republicans have been very supportive of the war on terror, but then you have some more of a libertarian wing of the party that's been growing with people like Rand Paul, who have been questioning the war on terror and the attack on our civil liberties. And so it'll be an interesting fight within the Republican Party over which wing of the party takes control on these issues. And so it'll be interesting to watch.
It will indeed. And your book, it was just a really fascinating read. Pay Any Price. Thank you so much, James Risen.
Thank you.
In addition to Pay Any Price, James Risen has written three other books, including State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Pay Any Price. Next up, George Marshall tells us why we don't want to think about global warming and how to change that. Stay tuned after the break.
You are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. 400,000 people marched to save the climate in September and then watched as climate-denying politicians were overwhelmingly elected to the U.S. Congress. Why, with the stakes so dire for our survival, is the political will to press for real solutions on the climate so lacking? Why, despite overwhelming scientific evidence, do we still ignore climate change? It's a question that my guest George Marshall seeks to answer in his terrific new book, Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change. He argues the problem is in the stories we tell or don't tell, and he calls for a new frame on climate change that breaks out of the environmental sphere to touch every aspect of our lives. Marshall is the founder of the Climate Outreach Information Network and writes the blog climatedenial.org.
Well, George Marshall, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
A lot of people write about, you know, why aren't we doing more about climate change from an institutional standpoint? But your purpose is different. You look at the psychological reasons. Why is that?
Yes, of course there's something which is going on with the structure of society, of the structure of the economy. And of course there's issues of power. And of course there is a misinformation campaign which is politically motivated. We know all of that. But for me, that just didn't adequately explain why decent, honorable people, people who are normally very alert to things right across the political range, just didn't seem to get this. I also think that there are good explanations in this for why it becomes so politically polarized, too. But I think, in particular, why also it's not talked about. The vast majority of people don't talk about it at all, and I think that's what led me also into the psychology of it. Really, a very simple thing, actually, which is the sort of the starting point almost for the book, is trying to ask why it is that the majority of people, even here in America, will say that climate change is a concern to them or a worry if they're asked about it. But if they're asked what is a worry for them, they don't mention climate change. Now, that's very unusual. Climate change has this weird capacity where people can be very concerned about it when they think about it, but not be able to bring it to mind when they're asked what they're concerned about.
You talk about there's two ways that the brain has of assimilating information. One is rational, the other is emotional. Tell us, why can we get so caught in the thickets that we can't really get climate change?
Amongst all the issues we deal with, climate change is particularly driven by information and data. I mean, we have to take a great deal of it on trust from scientists and make sense of it. I think other issues are much more clear and evident, and we can see them with more certainty. And this is a problem for us because we weigh up these kinds of information in different ways, and the brain has different processing systems for different kinds of information. So the rather abstract symbols, graphs, mathematical-based information behind climate change is processed in a different way from things which are concerned with immediate threat. Therefore, we tend to put it on one side. We like to think that we're very rational. We like to think that, you know, that we weigh things up in a balanced way. But there's a very large body of psychological research now to show that actually that's not the case. And we give an overwhelming precedence to things that push our emotional buttons. So, of course, seeing video of American or British citizens being beheaded after being kidnapped by terrorists presses every single one of our buttons in a very, very powerful way. A piece of research that suggests that on current trajectory, 2/3 of food production across the Midwest or across sub-Saharan Africa could disappear, and with enormous suffering for people as a result of climate change. That sounds awful, but we're not seeing the pictures, we're not seeing the images, and we're not seeing the enemies. So we work in this very basic way. And all of the cognitive psychologists I spoke to said the same thing over and over again. They said that we have to find a way of converting the abstract information-based material of climate change into something which speaks to that emotional side. And in the book, I argue that because we have to convert it in this way, it becomes very, very heavily laden with the values and the politics of the people who tell the story. It ends up only really existing and mobilizing us in the form of the stories we tell about it. And then because those stories are so based in who we are and the way that we speak, we then react to them in terms of the values that they carry. For me, this is the primary reason why people of conservative politics do not accept climate change, is they simply do not accept the way that the story about climate change has been told by people of more liberal and environmental politics.
And what is that story that they don't accept?
I think there's two aspects to that. I think it's what it contains and what it doesn't contain. The first thing to say is that climate change, in my view, should never have been an environmental issue. And that sounds a bit strange because everyone goes, well, of course it's environmental. But actually, it isn't really. It crosses all boundaries. As I just said, it can destroy food production. So it's an agricultural issue. It's a territorial issue. It's a water supply issue. It's a resource issue. It's a fossil fuel issue. It's a human rights issue. It's a religious and faith issue. It's anything at all you want it to be.
It's a moral issue as well.
We can keep adding to that. By any criteria of what concerns us, there is no reason to think that climate change could not be primarily defined in terms of that. So the fact that we have decided or that it has become defined as being environmental over and above all of those other meanings and readings is a huge limitation on it. I often like to think, what would climate change look like if, for example, there wasn't an environmental movement, but there was a very strong and powerful human rights movement? Because it is a huge human rights issue. As you say, it's a moral issue, and it's going to be the leading motor of future conflict. In fact, Red Cross says it already is. What would it look like? And the answer is, it would look completely different. The way we think and talk about it would be different, all the images would be different, and language would be different. And it would speak to people in a very different way. So environmentalists, and I count myself, I'm proud to be a member of the environmental movement, took hold of this issue when it first emerged in the 70s and then through into the 80s, and it seemed to be concerned with pollution and from industrial processes. It was associated with the way that we lived, and the solutions to it involved things which environmentalists like, things like using less stuff, using less oil and gas, doing things locally, maybe eating less meat. I mean, there's a lot of things there that environmentalists like. So it chimed very strongly. And of course, then what we did as environmentalists was we made it totally our own. We started using our own language and words around it. We started talking about, like, stop this, or defend this, or action on this. As a typical example of that is that we put our images all over it. So it became, the polar bear became the icon of climate change, and still is. In any media article, there's a polar bear there. If you go out and ask people in the street what they associate with climate change, they'll say polar bear and penguins. Why? Well, because that's what environmentalists put put there. In many ways, it's a lousy symbol. It really should never have been one. I mean, why on earth have an image of something associated with cold in order to communicate something to do with hot? You know, like I say in the book, like, you know, they don't. There's a reason why in advertising penguins are used for selling, you know, fridges and freezers and not selling ovens. And especially because it seems a very, very long way away. It's something outside people's lives, far away. So people go, oh, that's terrible. Yeah, let's save the polar bear. That is not what climate change is about. And, of course, no other organizations would ever have put a bear as their central icon. Because we understand climate change entirely through these images and this language, that becomes climate change. For people, climate change becomes the environmental issue about polar bears that's telling them that they can't use their car.
Yet, I wonder if that story is really changing, and that it's almost as if it's going from that story where people can distance themselves from climate change to another story that is so emotionally terrifying that people don't even want to look it in the face. And you start your book, George Marshall, Don't Even Think About It, by going to a place where people have just been through probably a climate-influenced disaster, a wildfire in Texas, and they don't even want to connect the dots between what's just happened to them, the loss of their community through wildfire and a climate-caused drought, and climate change.
It certainly was a surprise to me, although actually nothing should be a surprise. I think that the reason for that is because I think that we really are in new social and psychological territory with this. We've never faced anything quite like this. And I must say, as this century unfolds, all bets are off how this pans out, because we're quite capable of reacting in very strange ways. Of course, one would assume, as all the scientists and campaigners do, that when people go through extreme weather events, that therefore they're more inclined to accept climate change. After all, we think that it's hard for people to accept climate change because it's far away and it seems very abstract. As I said, it seems quite on that rational side of a brain. But surely when your house burns down, surely that moves over strongly onto that emotional side, you would think. But of course, it doesn't quite work like that, because our experience and how we interpret it is mediated through the stories we tell. And the thing I found in where you mentioned Bastrop in Texas, a third of a town burnt down. This was the biggest fire-related disaster in Texan history. But I also went actually to New Jersey as well and spoke to survivors of Hurricane Sandy. And what was clear was that the story which had developed there in their community was one of strength and resilience and rebuilding and reinvesting and hope, lots of very positive things, which allowed no space for the anxiety-provoking and distressing thought that this might be the harbinger of a pattern to come of increased and ever more extreme weather. The last people want to hear that are people who have just invested their very last savings in rebuilding their house. And they're also feeling good about themselves. They're not feeling good about their experience, but the communities are strong. They know that some people accept climate change and some don't. They don't want to talk about it. So it feels exploitative to talk about climate change when people are recovering from the event. It just goes to show how complex this issue is and how we cannot assume anything about it and how ready we are to push it on one side and to create silence around it.
You also talk about something called confirmation bias and biased assimilation. What are those things? How do they influence how we think about climate change?
Well, these are universal human qualities. If you, you know, I find myself thinking about, you know, did I buy the right house? And I find myself going, well, somebody said what a great house it was. Well, it seems like it looks beautiful in the photographs. And these are all ways that it's confirming the view I want to reach, which is that I made a right decision. And so I pull on the evidence which is around me. Even when something isn't going very well, you find yourself trying to pull together the arguments which fit the thing that you want. It's a basic way that we're wired to do things. So that's what we call confirmation bias. It's a bias towards cherry-picking the evidence that confirms the position we already have. The problem with climate change, as I said, is because it's rather abstract, the information is uncertain. Was Hurricane Sandy caused by climate change? Wasn't it? How much of it was? It puts us in a very strong position if we think that climate change is happening to say, yes, it was, and if we think it was not, to say, no, it wasn't. And it's a problem for climate change, for the impacts, these weather impacts, tend to come in the pattern of just simply being a lot more of something that we already have. California has a drought. California has always been dry, has always had droughts. So a record-breaking drought just seems like more the same. And on the basis of that, you decide, is this just evidence that that weather is variable and it can sometimes be extremely dry in California, or do you see it as proof of climate change? And we can keep doing this. We can keep doing this indefinitely. This is the danger. And also, we keep taking the measure of what we look at for what constitutes change from the most recent events. So the polar vortex, for example, which came down last winter, was that extreme? Well, not so extreme in terms of long-term temperature record. It only feels extreme because winters have been getting warmer and warmer. So we're always taking our measure from the most recent events. One of the experts in the psychology of risk said to me that if climate change turned the sky purple, it would be very different. But it doesn't. It simply delivers stuff that we're actually very, very good at adapting to and coping with and rebuilding from.
Until, of course, it doesn't.
We protect the president from danger, but we can't notice each and every stranger. So we set a clever trap. Then we went to take our nap. Odds are we won't be employed tomorrow. Secret service man needs a better plan. We learned of that fence jumper when we saw it on C-SPAN. White House agents always check for passes, but we can't see a thing through these dark glasses. There's a sign right on the door saying we'll be back at 4. Odds are we'll be reassigned to Fargo. Secret service shot. Now we're being mocked. Our next plan to guard the White House, make sure the door is locked. That's the latest Secret Service drama. Pretty soon new folks will watch Obama. His security, they say, is worse than Beyonce's. She has some bodyguards that he should borrow. Secret Service doubt what our job's about. We thought the fence was for Obama to keep him from jumping out.
And now for something completely different.